It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The U.S. Supreme Court, once again by telephone, is hearing oral arguments today and tomorrow on cases that could impact the presidential election. House Democrats and the New York State Attorney General are asking the justices to force President Trump to turn over his financial records, which he has resisted doing for the last 4 years. University of Pittsburgh Law School Dean Amy Wildermuth, who once clerked for the late Justice John Paul Stevens, says so far Trump has ignored state and congressional subpoenas.
And you know, this is a really interesting question. If you think about a congressional subpoena, Microsoft, Google, right, any of those places have to respond to congressional subpoenas. You and I have to respond to those congressional subpoenas. So the question that is being asked now is whether the president has some exception, some exemption from being required to respond.
So this involves all three branches of government. You have the president, you have the power of the congressional subpoena, and of course, you've got the high court involved.
Isn't it fascinating, right? It's one of those moments where you have all three branches of the government trying to figure out what is the right territory, what is the right space for each of us to occupy, and how do we overlap, how do we intersect, and how do we navigate that together? And so there have not been a whole lot of cases on executive power, but we have seen more in sort of recent years. So this will be one more of those challenges to see where the court is going to say the line is in terms of the congressional subpoena power and whether the president really does get an exemption or an exception.
And the other case, but also involving the president's finances, you mentioned involves a state grand jury. Is it possible the justices could rule two different ways on this because of the two different cases?
It is always possible, right? Because what we're looking at is the power of Congress versus the power of a state. And we could see that there could be some distinction made between whether Congress has the power to request this information at the, you know, the federal level versus a state's power to request this information.
Another case involves the Electoral College. There are 538 members who are supposed to vote for the presidential candidate that their state went for. So what's the issue here?
The issue is that we have lots of state laws that require those electors to go in and vote certain ways. And if you don't, there typically is some kind of punishment. For example, in the case that's being heard, $1,500 fine. So the question is whether, in fact, state laws that exist now are, in fact, okay, right? Are those lawful? Can we require electors to vote in certain ways? And that's the question that's being asked, right? Are you a robot or are you not a robot? Now, we've never had a presidential contest that has come down to the Electoral College in a significant way, right, at least in recent memory. But I think what these cases signal is that we probably ought to know what the law is on this going forward, because we had a few of those folks in the last election go in different directions.
Yeah, Donald Trump lost, I believe, two electors, and Hillary Clinton lost five.
Quite a few. And again, you add those up and you start having more of them, and then it changes the contest. And so the real question is whether electors are bound to do what state law requires them to do, or can they vote however they would like?
Where do you think the court's going to fall on this particular issue?
This is a tricky one to figure out exactly how the court's going to line up, because it feels political. It feels like there could be an answer in the liberal or conservative wing. I'm not sure that's true. These kinds of cases have always been hard to predict in terms of where folks will come out. It is a little bit about state power and federal power, so we might see some dynamics around sort of what states get to do and what states don't get to do. But of course, this is about a First Amendment question. What is it that individuals get to express or not express when they're in this role? And then can we criminally punish them if they don't follow what the rule is in the state? So I don't know that there's an easy breakdown. I'm really looking forward to the argument to see if we can get a little more insight into how the justices are thinking about the case.
Pitt Law Dean Amy Wildermuth, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. On Friday, most of southwestern Pennsylvania will transition from the red phase to yellow of COVID-19 reopenings. The stay-at-home order will lift, retail can resume, and gatherings of fewer than 25 people are permitted. But is it a good idea? 90.5 WESA Sarah Bowden talked with David Dossey, an epidemiologist at Duquesne University, who specializes in helping governments prepare for pandemics. She spoke with Dossey about what lies ahead.
Do you think now is the right time to loosen social distancing restrictions here in western Pennsylvania?
That's always a tough question, because the reality is that it appears that the social distancing has worked, and we have not had a huge surge here in western Pennsylvania. And so I think there is at least some optimism that easing these restrictions is a reasonable thing to do at this point, as long as people don't get carried away.
Do you think we'll see an increase in the coronavirus infection rate once southwest Pennsylvania transitions to yellow? And if so, by how much?
If people follow the guidelines provided by health professionals and others, there's a good chance that the answer to that is no, we won't see an increase. If people too quickly sort of run back to what is normal and think that because we don't have a huge number of cases that we can't get a large number of cases, then that could change.
One thing I'm wondering about, so on Friday, gatherings of fewer than 25 people will be permitted. Does that mean a gathering of this size is safe?
So it's really a probability game. You know, the larger the group and the more diverse the geography of the group, the greater the probability that some member of that group may actually be an asymptomatic carrier.
What do you plan to do? Do you plan to get together with some close friends and family now that the stay-at-home order will soon be gone? Or do you plan to continue isolating in your home?
I plan to continue isolating in my home. You know, if I do get together with family or friends, it will be a very different gathering. It will likely be outside. It will likely have seats that are spaced appropriately apart, in part because many of the loved ones that I want to spend time with are also those at greatest risk for potentially becoming severely ill if they were to get the disease. And I wouldn't want to put one of them at risk.
So you're not having anyone in your home, you're not giving hugs, things like that?
Absolutely not, no.
What about play dates for kids?
Well, I mean, everything is relative right now, I will tell you, because, you know, as we move ahead, and unless there is a vaccine or some type of innovation here medically, you know, safe is going to be a relative term for all of us. We all take risks when we go out in society, and that's risk for a wide variety of, you know, potential diseases, a wide variety of accidents. You could have a car accident. So the issue here is, you know, people have to understand that social interactions with others involve some level of risk. And as you increase the size of that group, it increases the risk.
I think the thing that I'm personally sometimes confused by, and I think a lot of people are, is how do you evaluate that risk?
Well, it's based on everyone's tolerance for risk, I think. Some people, I think, have too great of a tolerance for risk, and they end up putting other people in harm's way without the other, you know, people's permission. And so there's a difference between that. But this is really going to have to deal with everyone's comfort level. I've always said that the most common sense thing to do at this point is for high-risk people to take greater precautions than people who are at lower risk.
By your estimation, do you think we have enough testing and contact tracing capacity to monitor a possible increase of infections of the coronavirus?
I think that most places have challenges in that department. Right now, Allegheny County is a good example of a place where there are a limited number of cases. So if we play our cards right and we do test and we do contact trace and we do isolate the cases of people who have been in contact with sick people, we could potentially contain it and then do the common sense approach, which is just to limit the activities of people at greatest risk. That has always been the most common sense approach to this.
That was Duquesne epidemiologist David Dossey talking with WESA's Sarah Bowden. WESA receives funding from Duquesne. It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Doctors and nurses on the front lines of the pandemic have received a lot of gratitude, and with good reason. But the majority of COVID-19 deaths in Pennsylvania aren't in hospitals. They're in nursing homes. Workers there have been forced to say goodbye to countless patients that they've known for years. WHYY's Nina Feldman reports.
If there is one social activity that is a staple at virtually all nursing homes, it's bingo. But gathering for game night is not an option these days. That's why Mildred Ives, who lives at a nursing home near Wilkes-Barre, says she's grateful that the staff there have gone out of their way to keep bingo going.
They give us bingo cards, and we get to mark off the numbers and turn your papers back in. If you win, you get a quarter. We play it right in our rooms with the doors shut. Bingo's a big game in the nursing homes.
Nursing home staff also bathe residents and feed them and take them to the bathroom. They aren't paid much, less than $15 an hour on average. As many workers have called out sick with COVID-19 or to stay home with their kids or other loved ones, many nursing homes have found themselves short-staffed right when they need the most help.
You are asking the nurses to go from monitoring vitals once a week to maybe every 2 to 4 hours for patients that have COVID.
Josh Wee is medical director at Renaissance Nursing Home in Philadelphia.
The escalation in intensity of assessment is ramping up as you're losing staff, and that is not a doable situation at all.
Julie Moore works as a certified nursing assistant at a nursing home in Philadelphia. She says there aren't enough staff to assign one group of nurses to patients with COVID-19 and another to patients without. Even if there were, tests aren't widely available to know who has the virus and who doesn't. There's also a shortage of personal protective equipment, so she wears the same mask and gown all day, no matter who she's caring for. All of this can be hard to explain to the residents.
You know, they look to us for everything, and we don't know how to explain what's going on to them, especially the residents who have Alzheimer's or dementia, and they see us all covered up, suited and booted, as we call it.
Moore said she's had dozens of residents die on her watch. Once the tally rose above 40, she stopped keeping count.
And then you got to come in the next day, and then you find out that another resident has either gone out to the hospital or passed away. So it's a lot.
Despite that, she does her best to keep her residents connected with their families. If she happens to see a loved one at the building hoping to wave at a resident through the window, she'll offer to take their phone up to that resident's room, snap a photo, and bring it back down. And when someone dies, she says she feels responsible.
You rewind in your head, I know I do, is there something that I could have done differently, you know, to help? And at the end of the day, it wasn't anything differently. Like, this thing came in, you know, like a roller coaster and had us all on a really long ride. And we're still on it.
Nina Feldman, Philadelphia.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. They say there's success in routine, but what happens when all that's normal has gone out the window? Parents across America have been learning the hard way as the coronavirus shutdown has forced most everyone to adapt. With kids' classrooms replaced by the kitchen table or living room couch, many parents have been reluctantly drafted into a new role, teacher's assistant. National surveys say moms are doing most of this work. Keystone Crossroads' Miles Bryan checked in with some about the joys of distance learning.
Jennifer Byers knows she's one of the lucky ones. The Northwest Philly mom isn't in financial distress, and she and her husband have just one kid, a 10-year-old son named Jamie. So why does this distance learning thing feel so overwhelming?
I feel like we should be doing more. And part of us not doing more is because I don't have the bandwidth. And I feel like I feel like people saying that.
Byers works for a big multinational financial firm. She says the hardest part about remote learning is switching from that role to math teacher or tantrum soother and back over and over again.
I used to have that 20-minute commute to switch or decompress, and now it's a flight of stairs, and then I need to be on, and that's really hard.
Byers says her son Jamie is doing fine, keeping up with his work and chatting with his buddies all day online. But she says the stress of remote learning has been taking its toll on her marriage. She's found herself bickering with her husband over little things like Jamie's schedule. She says she is ready to ditch this new normal.
I don't know what school is going to look like next year. I'm hoping they come up with the vaccine. I will be first in line because I want to get everybody out of the house.
For Ebony Wilcox, staying home sounds like a luxury. The Delaware County single mom still goes to work 7 to 3 Monday through Friday, and sometimes the weekends, at a home for people with intellectual disabilities.
I'm getting phone calls during the day. This teacher said that. That teacher said this. I wish I could be home because I feel like, you know, the rest of the world is spending time with their kids that I'm not. I feel like my kids are missing out because I have to come to work.
Wilcox says her kids' teachers are doing their best, but they can't compete with teachers in wealthier districts with access to more and better technology. She says her 17-year-old daughter and 14-year-old son receive just a handful of hours of direct instruction a week, and it doesn't seem to be helping them grow.
What can you learn in that little amount of time? I feel like my kids stop learning after their last day of school. It's not the amount, it's not the rigor, it's nothing like where, you know, this happened.
Wilcox is considering cyber charter schools, who she says at least already have some practice with online education.
I can't have my kids not learning. I can't have you just giving them busy work. I can give them busy work.
The shutdown has been a humbling experience for Angela Kearney, who lives in Pottstown. The furloughed paralegal is now supervising 2 kids and 2 grandkids, ages 8 to 13. One of them has been struggling with math, or so Kearney thought.
I kept saying, no, this is the answer, this is the answer. And my third grader, who's in special education, said to me, Mom, that is not the answer, it's 21. So we typed in 21 and the child was right. So it doesn't matter how many degrees you have, your third grader may be right.
Every weekday, Kearney tries to recreate school as best she can. The morning starts with a reading lesson. Math is in the afternoon. After lunch, the kids get a short recess in the yard.
I'm trying to help our teachers by educating them the same way at home so that when they go back, normalcy will occur.
Kearney's 13-year-old son, Christian, says it can be tough splitting 2 laptops between 4 kids, but he's not worried about making it through the rest of the year online. After that, though, Christian wants to be back at school, and he's got a message for any adults who've been ignoring social distancing guidelines.
Yes, us kids today are bad, but like we're really trying to have a summer. And I'm pretty sure they are too, so I would suggest you stay home.
For Keystone Crossroads, I'm Miles Bryant.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Production assistance from Helen Wicker, Tom Hurley, and Julia Zenkovich. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. Today we say farewell to our producer and engineer, Kylie Kozinski. Kylie, Megan, and I teamed up 2 years ago to create the daily version of The Confluence. Kylie's amazing audio editing and engineering skills and wonderful news judgment have made The Confluence what it is. We will miss working with you on a daily basis, Kylie, but the good news is you'll hear much more of her in the coming days. Kylie is remaining with WESA as a reporter. Kylie, thanks for all you've done, and we look forward to having you as a guest on The Confluence. Until next time, I'm Kevin Gavin. Hope you have a good day of good news.